we turn once again to the book of Psalms and we come back again to Psalm number 5. I say that we come back again to Psalm number 5 because you may remember that last Wednesday we were in this psalm and we were looking at verse number 2. The previous week, you may recall, we were looking at the end of Psalm number 7, where the psalmist was saying, "I will praise the Lord according to his righteousness." And last Wednesday, we were in Psalm 5 at verse 2, and the psalmist was making the resolution to pray, "For unto thee will I pray." And I want to come back again to this psalm and to consider verse number 7. We made reference to verse 7 last time when we're talking about prayer and how the psalmist was going to come apart and come into the temple of God and he would worship there in fear. And we were noticing how sometimes we have to come apart in order to pray and leave other things behind and, as it were, outside. I want us to think this evening about the resolution that the psalmist makes. I will worship. I will praise, I will pray, I will worship, he says in verse number 7 of Psalm 5. But as for me, I will come into thy house in the multitude of thy mercy, and in thy fear will I worship toward thy holy temple. And here again we have one of these resolutions that the psalmist is speaking about. This is something that he is going to do. We noticed last time that the psalmist was praying in the context of some difficulty. And there are those who are against him. And God has no pleasure in those who have no righteousness in their mouth. But the psalmist is going to pray, but he's also going to worship. And this means, of course, that the circumstances of his life are not going to dictate how he is going to respond to God. He is going to do what God requires him to do, whether the time is ripe or whether the time is not all that convenient. We're reminded, you remember, in the book of Daniel of how Daniel prayed 3 times a day. And Daniel, it seems, was holding some high office in the land of Babylon. And he was undoubtedly a busy man, but he never became a Babylonian. He remained an Israelite all his days, even in the midst of Babylon. And he practiced his faith. His faith was sustained, and his faith was indeed expressed in the habitual practice of prayer and indeed of other things. And in chapter 6, you remember, even when the decree of King Darius was that no one was to pray for a period except to him or through him, Daniel did as he always did, and he prayed 3 times, opened his window, kneeled down publicly, not to make a display, but not to cover or hide in shame or fear. He simply carried on doing what he was always doing. And that shows the caliber of the man, really, and whatever people would say about it or whatever prohibitions would be laid upon him, he was going to pray and he was going to worship God. So part of our prayer is worship and part of our worship is prayer. These are two activities that are, as it were, two different aspects of the one coin. Indeed, they are part of a multifaceted coin because prayer and worship and a whole host of other things are all involved together and you cannot really separate them one from the other. To worship by definition would include prayer and a true prayer by definition must include true worship. So we're going to look then this evening at this particular aspect of the psalmist's resolution. And we want to learn for our learning and for our example, to be challenged and to be encouraged. Because here yet again we have another example of the practice of the religion of the Bible. It's a practical thing. It's something we do. It's not just a matter of feeling. It's not a matter of private inward meditations and devotions and having good moments or bad moments within our soul. It's a matter of doing things before God that are out of the ordinary, not simply, as it were, worshipping God by ordinary ways, but setting time and places apart in order to give ourselves to this great activity of worship. So we want to make some comments this evening about worship as we come to Psalm number 5 at verse number 7. The first thing we want to do is to try to explain as we can the meaning of the word. The word is shacha, and in the Hebrew word that mean in the language that means to bow down low. It means to do obeisance. It means in places to fall flat on your face. And the idea that lies behind the word that is used for worship is the idea of taking a lowly place, taking our proper place before God who is most high. We have an example of this in the book of Nehemiah in chapter 8. You remember the people, when they heard the word of the Lord, they fell down and they worshipped. And at the very end of Isaiah's prophecy, you remember the last chapter, verse number 23, the prophet is reminding us that in the end, all the nations are going to come before the Lord, and they're going to worship before him. Isaiah is seeing a day coming when the Gentiles, along with the Jewish people, will be brought to Zion, and their response will be essentially the same. It is to worship the Lord. And you remember how Isaiah then goes on to speak about, on the one hand, there are people worshipping the Lord, and there are others who have refused to worship, and their carcasses are, as it were, outside in that place where the fire is never quenched, the worm never dies, and the very sight of them is going to be an abhorrence and something that is offensive in the sight of all the gathered universe. So the prophet Isaiah closes his prophecy by a stark contrast. We either worship God and we enter into the glory, or we do not worship God and we go to that place where we become an abhorrence to all flesh. And that's the meaning of how Isaiah finishes off his great prophecy, the evangelical prophet of the Old Testament. In the book of Psalms, this word occurs 16 times in total, another 15 references. And I'm sure you'll have noticed that in the Psalms that we were reading, in Psalm 95 and 99 and 29, was it? In each of these Psalms, this idea of worship indeed has been mentioned, and on each occasion it has been, let us come down and worship him. The Lord is high, worship before his footstool. O come and let us worship him, in Psalm 95, for example, because he is our God and we are the people and the sheep of his pasture. So there are all these references in Psalm number 22, for example, verses 27 and 29. That psalm speaks of the suffering of Christ and the glory that should follow, and one of the consequences of Christ's suffering on the cross of Calvary is that he is going to be spoken of throughout all the world, and all nations are going to come, and his gospel is going to be believed, and the response to that gospel is going to be worship of the living and the true God. So there are many references in the scriptures, and over again, as we say in the Psalms, we have these ideas of coming to worship, inviting the nations are to come to worship. All the ends of the earth shall worship him. All flesh whom thou hast made shall come and worship reverently before thee, as the psalmist says in another place. So the idea of worship is pretty clear, and the New Testament idea is exactly the same. The word that is used is a word that means to do obeisance, to show respect. There are places where it can have a showing of respect to a fellow man who is in high office, giving respect where respect is due, reverence to whom reverence is due. But when it is used in reference to God, it always, without exception, has essentially the same idea, and that is recognizing the difference that there is between what he is and what we are, recognizing that difference and not just turning and saying, well, ho-hum or whatever, but appropriately responding with prostration, coming down. Because ultimately that is the place of the sinner and the creature before the most holy God, at least according to the teaching of the Bible. So that's what the word basically means. But our word, our English word, worship, is rather an interesting word, because it means worth-ship. And this, you could hardly get a better word in the English language to speak of what the Hebrew words and the Greek words are speaking about, because it means that we are recognizing that God is to be taken seriously. He is to be taken as one who is worthy of our attention, One of the big problems of the world is that it is under a complete misunderstanding of what God is like. The scripture, again and again, links together unbelief and indifference to God with ignorance of God. And there are a number of places where in the Bible, when men come to recognize what God is like, when they have a vision of God, there's no more indifference. Every single occasion when God manifests himself to men, there is a sense of terror, a sense of awe, a sense of one who is far, far greater than we will ever be or anything that we've ever become familiar with. And you have the classic example of that, of course, in Isaiah's vision in the 6th chapter of his prophecy when he saw the Lord high and lifted up. Now, the scholars argue, and I don't know which side of the debate to come down on because I don't know. There are those who say that that was the beginning of Isaiah's ministry, and there are good arguments for that. And there are those who say that Isaiah was already a prophet and that the Lord was reinforcing him by giving him this vision because he was to give Isaiah a very difficult task to perform, to go and preach to people who weren't going to listen to him. And a man certainly needs a measure of reinforcement to spend his ministry preaching to unappreciative and unheeding people. And so the Lord was reminding Isaiah at the very beginning of this new commission or this new dimension to his prophetic ministry. And the prophet, you remember how he responded. He saw the Lord, and the Lord was high and lifted up, sitting up on a throne. All was glorious. His train was filling the temple. All the holy ones gathered there were worshiping and doing obeisance and hiding their faces before the glory of him who is the most high, holy God of Israel. And Isaiah himself, you remember how he was convicted of how unclean he was. If, in fact, he was already a prophet, he was a good prophet, a pure prophet. He was orthodox and he was a sincere man. God called, and God would give him revelations and words to speak. And yet the prophet was aware of how his very lips, the instrument of God's message through him, his very lips were unclean in the presence of this holy, holy, holy God. And he confesses and he recognizes that he is undone by nature and he needs his sin to be purged and taken away and given a new impetus for this new dimension of his ministry. So that response from the prophet Isaiah is in many ways a pretty typical response. You remember how the people of Israel, when they gathered around Mount Sinai in the book of Exodus, and they saw something of the glory of the Lord. They saw the mountain all shaking and smoking. And we don't know exactly what it was that they were seeing, and they heard voices and rumblings, and we don't exactly know what that was. It certainly was more than simply a volcanic or some kind of earthly disruption. It was something in which God was manifestly and obviously present. And the people trembled, and the people were frightened. And the people asked that a distance be kept because they recognized that if God were to pour down the mountain towards them, that they would not be able to stand. In other words, you see, the point is that there is no indifference, there's no casual approach when we are told in the Bible of people worshiping. And one of the great tragedies of our world is that people don't know what God is like. And if God were to reveal himself this evening to us here tonight, or to the multitudes in Sydney going about their business, lawful or unlawful or whatever it may be, there'll be an instant stopping and an instant putting into proper perspective all these earthly activities, because we'd recognize that here is one who is to be taken seriously, and here is one who is mighty in power, and there is nothing like him in the whole of the world. He is different. He is high and lifted up, and there's a great gulf between him and everything else. He belongs to that realm of creatorhood and everything else, the furthest stars and galaxies and the smallest things that we'll ever look at, they all belong to the created order. And everything is so ordinary in comparison to God. And so the psalmist here, when he is saying, "I will worship," he is recognizing that God is worthwhile. He is recognizing that this is not some foolish thing to do. That when he comes into God's temple and to fall down before him, this is not something foolish. This is not something in which he's going to be embarrassed to do it. It is something that he regards as very, very important. Indeed, it is something that he sees as being a proper response. And so when we worship God and prostrate ourselves And I hope that all of us have these moments when, in the privacy of our own closet or wherever we are, we bow down. You will find in many of the testimonies of some of the great men and women of God that they had this sense of humility, and bowing their face in prostration before God was hardly a lowly enough thing for them to do. They couldn't get low enough as they recognized how great what God was and how unworthy they are before Him. And so this is not something that is a mark of some kind of insanity or unreality. To come before God with this deep sense of humility and deliberately to humble ourselves before Him is a sign, surely, of rationality. It's a sign of intelligent human creatures made in God's image. The man who never bows his knee to God, the Bible tells us, he's a fool. However much wisdom the world may imagine he has, or whatever he thinks he is himself, he may well have a string of degrees as long as you care to mention. But the point is, from the biblical perspective, the man's a fool, and he's living in a kind of a dream world, because he is imagining that there is nothing higher than himself, and he's going to bow to no one. Maybe occasionally the great ones of the earth, but not to the great God of heaven, whom no man has ever seen or in this world can see. And so this is the idea of worshipping. It is the idea of recognizing that God is worthy, but in comparison to God, we are unworthy. You see, how does the Bible speak of us? Now, the Bible speaks of mankind, in very high and glowing terms, actually. There are places where we are like unto the angels, the angels indeed are called the servants of the children of God, the sons of men. And we are made in the image of God. So man has a dignity. Let us not imagine that we're just worms. And let us be very careful how we speak about ourselves and our fellow men. Because God recognizes that there is a dignity and a value in man. And that is why God is willing to make His Son in our image, in the likeness of sinful flesh. That's why Christ became a man. The Bible tells us He did not take upon Him the nature of angels. He took upon Him the seed of Abraham. He was made like unto His brethren. He became like us. And that was a humiliation, but it was not a degradation. Because in taking flesh, Christ was not degraded. He was humiliated. But it is within the dignity of the Godhead to be identified with man in this particular way, even by taking flesh, because man is precious to God, and man has a certain dignity. So we have to be careful that we don't speak of ourselves as if we're just animals or as nothing, because the Bible doesn't speak. It speaks symbolically. A worm I am. The Bible speaks symbolically. But when the Bible seriously speaks about man, it speaks of him as being of value to God. What is man that thou art mindful of him, says the psalmist. When he looked up to the heavens and saw everything that God had made, how great it was, how complex. And when he looked at man, he began to wonder, well, why does God take care of man? And then he answers the question, does he not? Thou hast made him a little lower than the angels. On earth you have made him to be the Lord over the work of your hands. He is the Lord over creation. That is why God takes note of man. Because he's not just an ordinary earthly creature. He is the supreme creature according to the Bible. And one of the things, you know, that atheists and humanists and materialists today love to tell us, they love to tell us, all the books, they seem to get onto this mantra, we are just an ordinary little planet living on the edge of an ordinary little galaxy, and so on and so on. And there's always this emphasis upon the ordinariness of man. And yes, looked at from one angle, that probably could well be understood. But looked at from the Bible, there is a uniqueness about our world. There is a uniqueness about our life and about our dignity as man. And so when we come before God, we are recognizing that there is a dignity that God allows us to worship Him. As far as I know, we are the only creatures on earth that worship God. That is what makes, that's one of the marks of man. That's one of the attributes, if you like, of man being in the image of God. He is made to worship. He's made for fellowship. And we're made to think. We are made to make a moral as well as an intellectual response to God. That is what makes us different. And we have a brain that God has created in order that we will be able to function in that high spiritual mental existence. And so to come to God in prayer and in worship is to recognize, yes, we are allowed to come because we are precious to God, but it's also to recognize that we are his creatures. We will never be anything else but creatures. And even in the glory to come, we will still be creatures. But not only are we creatures, but by nature we are sinful creatures. We are rebellious and we are disobedient creatures by nature. And we are lost creatures. And unless God saves us, we will be nothing else but lost creatures. But the psalmist is responding to God in worship because he knows something else. And I'll come back to this later on in the sermon. He knows that he is not just a creature and a sinner, but he knows that he is redeemed. It is because of mercy, he says, that he's going to come before God and worship before him. And I will worship. As for me, I will come into thy house in the multitude of thy mercy. Mercy has something to do with our worship, as we're going to see in a moment. So to come before God in worship is to recognize that God is what he is, who he is, what he requires. It is to recognize ourselves, who we are, what are we to do in response to God. We are to come and to fall down before him, and that is our place, and he respects us, and he receives us, and he blesses those who worship him, and he curses those who do not worship him, according to the teaching of the Bible. And that means, you see, the psalmist is recognizing, and we have to recognize also, that God gives us opportunities to worship. And that is why the prophet Daniel was taking time out from being whatever he was in the government of Babylon. We don't know. Maybe next door to the prime minister or something like that. He certainly was a high civil servant of some kind. But out of his busy administrative life, he would take time out to worship God. He would spend time. And he would say, as it were, it's time now to pray. It's time now for me to lay aside the great business of state and to come and deal with the business of my relationship to God. And he would fall down and he would worship before the Lord. He would take time. He recognized that his life was a life in which day by day there were opportunities. Now, you and I have to recognize that. We have opportunities to worship. And if we are too busy to take time apart to worship God, then we are too busy doing things that God has not asked us to do. When God requires of us worship, he recognizes that this takes time. He recognizes there are things to be laid aside temporarily to give this time to him. And if we are occupied always, as they say nowadays, 24/7, or is it 7/24? I can never get it right. But whatever it is, if there are people say, if there's not enough hours in the day, then there's something fundamentally wrong with our life. There's something wrong with our lifestyle, because there's something wrong with our worldview. We may think that this world is here to be occupying our time. It is not here to be occupying our time overmuch. We are to put God first, and everything else will fall into place. So God gives us opportunities, as it were. He gives us places. He gives us people. And that is why it is good to be regulated and to be habitual, as it were, to make a point as best we can to attend all the worship services of a congregation. And there are people who, it is evident, they don't take that issue seriously. And they say, well, we can worship God in private, so they can. We're not saying they can't. But that's not what David's talking about. He's talking about coming into the temple. No doubt David had his quiet closet. Now, there are those who say, well, the temple wasn't built when David was king. That's true, it wasn't. But he had the tabernacle, and it was in the city of David, and the tabernacle and the temple are essentially the same thing. Indeed, there are places where the tabernacle is called the temple of God. So when David says here that he comes into God's temple, he is speaking biblically. And what he probably means ultimately is that he's coming before God in his heavenly temple, because David knows, as we know from other psalms, that God can't be contained in earthly houses. God, the house that David would build for God couldn't contain God. David knew enough about God to know that. that God was higher than any temple that David or anybody else could ever think of building for him. So this is not incongruous language, but it is language that reminds us that David valued the presence of God's people. This was the place where God's people were to gather. And we know this from Psalm 84, where for a time the psalmist couldn't worship with God's people. And he was looking back with nostalgia and looking forward with anticipation of worshiping in God's house again. And he was envious of the very birds that were up in the rafters and making their nests, the swallows finding a place to lay their young in the temple roofs of the rafters of God's house. And he was wishing he was like one of them and having access to God's place, because God's people would be there, you see. And that was where God and his people would, in a very real sense, gather together. So worship is something that is essentially internal. It is spiritual. It is a mental grasp of who God is and what we are. But it is also outward. It's practical. David says, I will come into thy temple and I will worship there amongst all the others as a worshiper, not as king of Israel, but as a creature, a sinner, and a worshipper of the God of Israel. But there's another point I want to emphasize, and it is this. It's this aspect of mercy. He says, but as for me, I will come into thy house in the multitude of thy mercy, and in thy fear will I worship toward thy holy temple. This fear, of course, is that holy reverence that is due unto God. The moment we recognize him, we fear to offend him, we fear to lose him, we fear to bring disgrace upon his name. He becomes precious to us. But David especially is emphasizing mercy. Now, of course, when we think of mercy, we are to come to the throne of grace for mercy. We're told that in Hebrews. And there are many places in the Old Testament where God's people were told how they came to God and they asked for mercy. In the Psalms, we find this over and over again. Be merciful to me, O God. Thy mercy unto me do thou extend, because my soul doth put her trust in thee. So there is no question that the psalmist would come before God and bow before him seeking mercy. And that is true, so we accept that. We come to the throne of grace for mercy and for grace. But also there's another side to this, and that is that because we have already found mercy, we come to God in worship. In other words, worship is a fruit of already having received mercy. And I think that this is what David particularly is referring to here. It's not in order to find mercy, it's because he has already found mercy. And so here is a man who knows mercy upon mercy in the multitude of thy mercy. Whatever David was, and he was a very sinful man, as we know, the Bible doesn't hide the dark spots of David's character. The Bible reveals a great deal concerning the dark side of David. But the Bible also recognizes that David was a man of deep penitence, and he was a man after God's own heart, and he hated sin. And he would know very well what Paul is talking about in Romans chapter 6, the good that I would, I do not. The evil that I would not do is what I do. I've got no doubt whatsoever that in these great sins that David committed, he felt disgust and remorse, even although he would try to cover it up. Deep down, he knew that he was a disgusting character by nature, and left to himself, he was absolutely out of control. But he knew that there was such a thing as mercy, and yet with thee forgiveness is, that feared thou mayest be. And so what David is saying is that he is coming to God and he's worshiping God because he knows that God is worthy, because God has shown sheer mercy to him. And we've got to grasp this, that the religion of the Bible, the Old Testament as well as the New Testament, emphasizes over and over again that the lives of God's people result from salvation. We have sometimes entertained the idea of the natural man, and that is that you worship God and you keep the commandments or do whatever it is that people want to do in order to obtain mercy. And there are people even today throughout our world, and they take religion very seriously, and they're struggling and they're striving to do whatever it is their religion tells them to do in order to obtain mercy. But when we come to the Bible, we find that it's the very opposite way around. Our salvation begins in mercy. And when God would give the Ten Commandments to Israel, and tell them how to live according to these commandments and have no other God before him. It's because he has already shown them mercy. I am the Lord your God who took you. I've already taken you out of the land of Egypt, out of the house of bondage. He had already given mercy to them. And the keeping of his commandments now is not in order to obtain mercy. It is in order to express their appreciation and their gratitude for mercy. And one of the sure marks that you and I know God and that we understand forgiveness and that we know what it means to be saved by grace and not by works, one of the sure marks, the inevitable instinctive responses of our life will be that we will worship this God. We will not take his mercy and then go on and live as if we had never experienced mercy. Because mercy is the greatest thing that can ever happen to us as sinners, you see. To have our sins forgiven and forgotten and blotted out and never to come under their condemnation again, that is a most gratuitous act on God's part. And how then are we going to express such a magnitude of mercy except by those moments when we come and we acknowledge that he has done it all and we give him all the praise and all the glory? You see, this worshipping of God is an expression of the fact that David's heart is tender and he is living according to a man who's living the new life in Christ, that new life that is a new hope, a new direction, and indeed a new love. As the psalmist puts it in Psalm 116, I love the Lord because he heard my voice and my supplication. I cried unto him. And he heard me. I love him because he first of all has loved me. And that's the way it is throughout the whole of the Bible. And when we find God's people in the Old Testament or in the New, when we find them walking before the Lord in the fear of the Lord, it's because they know how close run a thing it was for them. They received mercy, but it was by the skin of their teeth, so to speak. They didn't deserve it, but they received it. And they're walking now on tender toes, so to speak. And they will worship. And the man who doesn't worship God is a man who ought really to question whether he has ever known anything in his own experience of the multitude of thy mercy. How many sins have we ever committed? Well, I don't know how many I've committed. There's no way we can know. Bishop Ryle, in one of his writings somewhere, has a rather interesting calculation. And he works out, well, how many years are we going to live? How many days? How many hours? How many times do you think a sin a day? And he is not coming to firm conclusions. He's simply trying to present to us the enormity, the sheer number of our sins. And every one of these sins has been, as it were, pardoned individually. God just doesn't say, I forgive your sin. He forgives all their sin. He forgives all their sins. He knows exactly what these sins are. When a sinner comes before God and God forgives, it's not that God doesn't know what he's doing, what sins the man's talking about. God's probably forgiving sins that the man doesn't even know about. But God knows, and each sin is forgiven as a sin. So how many times has God forgiven our sins? I wouldn't even begin to understand how to answer that question. And David doesn't do so. He just says it's a multitude. It's a multitude of mercy. And day by day, David walked as a man upon whom multitudes of mercies were being poured. And he was responding with gratitude and humility. And one of the things that mercy does too, before I pass on, time has gone away with us again, is that it gives us a concern for other people. One of the things that we do when we come to worship before God is that we're not just seeking to gratify ourselves and do our little religious bit, and then having performed our bit, we then go on and live life. No, we do it because we want to glorify God, but we also want to represent other people. In Psalm 119, for example, the psalmist says, rivers of waters flow down from my eyes when I see men going on in sin and they do not keep your law. And later on in the same psalm, he says that as he saw sinners going on, he says they are not glorifying God. You see, a concern for other people is inevitably a fruit of the fact that God has shown concern towards us. And that will drive us into the temple of God. And that will drive us to pray. Not selfish prayers, me and mine, but worldwide prayers, Jews and Gentiles, the wicked, the righteous, the religious, the irreligious. How much time do we spend worshiping God and in that worship praying to Him to have mercy upon our neighbors, our rulers, our enemies? And the list is endless. But you see, there's also something else, and I'm just going to have to mention these final points that I want to emphasize. First of all, the meaning of the word, then the idea of worship, and then there's the basis of mercy, the idea of mercy. But also, when we come to worship God, it means that we're rejecting certain things. We're rejecting atheism. It means we're rejecting idolatry. Idolatry can have different forms. It's possible to be an idolater and yet be a secularist. It may well be that we're putting our families, our wife, our children, our country, the flag, whatever it be, the football club that we support, whatever it be, that may well become our God in the sense that we give our time and our devotion. We wouldn't miss it for worlds. We'll spend $70 on a football ticket to go to the match, but we won't give 5 cents to the Salvation Army Red Appeal, you see. The church always wanting money, you know. Or we'll go into the pub and buy a round of drinks because our mates in our club, they are the thing that we live for. So if we are worshiping God, all these things will be put away. There will be nothing that will be more important to us than God. We will not be atheists because we will believe in the God of the Bible. And that means that we believe that He is the only living and true God. But we will have no idols beside Him. Our family won't be our idol. Our little darling children won't be our idols. God will be first. And we will not be our own idol. And the $5 note in our pocket will not be our idol. So we will put away other things in order to come and to worship before God. And there are other things I was going to say about that, but I don't have time. There's one final observation before I finish this evening. And that is this. This is the supreme activity of the Christian church, as it was the supreme activity of the Old Testament church. There were those occasions in Israel called holy convocations. Every Sabbath day in Israel was a holy convocation. It was to be kept holy to the Lord. And so week by week, the people of God were reminded to stop thinking about earthly things for a time and start thinking about holy things. And the Bible tells us how, in principle, we are to observe these holy days. So the point is that this is the great activity of God's people as far as God's commandments are concerned. Nothing will substitute for this. Evangelism, door knocking, witnessing, nothing substitutes for a true worship. And this is the great need of the church. Now, I'm emphasizing that for a particular reason. And the reason is this: we are living in a world, or in a time in the world, where increasingly the Christian church is telling us, or we're being told within the Christian community, and being told by the world as to what the Christian community should be doing, by the way. The world's now running the program and the agenda for Christian activity. And we're being told that our supreme function as Christians is to be witnessing to the world, to be feeding the poor, doing all the nice things and the kind things that Jesus did. I put to you, that's not the first priority of the church at all. Worship does not flow from witness. Witness flows from worship. And our worship will be a paltry thing. Our witnessing, rather, will be a paltry thing. It won't even be sincere. Because if we do not take seriously our own relationship to God, how can we possibly take seriously the world's relationship to God? The man who is most concerned for the world and who is most interested and concerned and burdened to witness for Christ is the man who first of all puts God first. And it's because God is important to him. God is first in his life. Worship, then witness, not the other way around. It's possible for someone to be engaged in a great deal of Christian activity, reaching out for the Lord, and never spending time before God in worship. That is a living lie. That's a very dangerous deception. and it is a violation of the biblical order of importance. There is nothing that is more important in your life and mine that we should worship God. That is fundamental. It's so obvious. I'm almost embarrassed to say it, but it needs to be said. Because sometimes we have a strange tendency and a determination almost to put the cart before the horse, as they say. So David here is getting his priorities right. He's the king in Israel. He's got many things to do. And he has many things that need to be put right. He's got burdens. But I will come into thy house. In the multitude of thy mercy and in thy fear, I will worship toward thy holy temple. And our Lord Jesus Christ has quite a lot of things to say about worship. And in John chapter 4, verse 19 onwards particularly, he says, worship is not a matter of worshiping on Mount Gerizim or on Mount Zion or wherever. It's a matter of spirit and in truth. That's the kind of worship that God requires and desires and will only accept. God is a spiritual being, and our worship essentially is a spiritual activity. And that is what makes it so important and so difficult, but also what makes it so much of a blessing and makes it so pleasing to God. This is the need of the hour, you see, that Christian people would make a habit and a resolution not to miss occasions and opportunities for worship. There's a lot more in this text and in this whole theme than we have time to talk about now, but our time is gone. But may God bless His word to us.